Well, hello everyone. It is July the 17th of 2021, and I'd like to start a series, I hope will be a series. The message is called the Jerusalem Chronicles. It's been, just as an aside here, it's been an incredibly dry summer or spring here in Canada. We had some rain early, but not so much of late. Our crops are burning up. Some people are harvesting them for silage, taking what they can. And there's a lot of wildfires burning up in the northern part of the province, and three of them actually where we have our cabin. So I guess we'll have to see how it goes. There was some showers here just within the last half hour, but we really haven't seen any rain for a while. So things still remain quite treacherous. There's a couple of things to touch on before going on with this message that springs out of the calendar conundrum message. For the technically prudent folks out there, the conjunction of the moon occurs when the moon is between the earth and the sun, something that was pointed out to me and subsequently confirmed after the last message. You may want to check that out as well to bring our understanding up to another level. Another thing I'd come across and had not mentioned, but consider significance in calendar musings, is that in the sacrificial system of God that he had in place, we often see the phrase yearly or a lamb of the first year in Scripture. And I had seen that traditionally lambing time occurred in February/March, which made sense, as the lush grasses would have made good food for the future mums before the hot, dry summer periods. Some of these would have been used for Passover, but that gives the question, or produces the question, well, how old did a lamb need to be accepted by God? If they were born in March, and Passover could have been in March, did God allow, or were they acceptable before him at a very young age? Do we get any information at all about that in the Scriptures? And I did not know the answer to the question. It turns out he does tell us, and I just didn't know it. Here's a couple of references for you, in case that's something you'd like to file into your, how about that, I didn't know that before, file. In Exodus 22:30, God says, likewise you shall do with your oxen and your sheep, it shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. And so a newborn animal was an acceptable sacrifice before God after it had been on its mum or with its mum for 7 days. We see that repeated in Leviticus 22, and verse 27, where it says, when a bull or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall be 7 days with its mother, and from the eighth day and thereafter it shall be accepted as an offering made by fire to Jehovah. Well, God designed those animals so that indeed would be so. So I thought it was curious that the lambs were born in the February-March time frame, just in time for the Passover season. So you can tuck that away. I didn't know that, and we need to fix stuff we don't know. And it's always wise to begin by defining a term when you're going to talk about something so everyone is on the same page. The word, quote-unquote, chronicle isn't a word we hear a lot in everyday usage. If we take the time to look up chronicle in thesaurus.com, which is one of my favorite references, we get a fuller sense of the word by seeing its various synonyms associated with it. And here are a few. So the word chronicles, then, it can mean annals, diary, journal, archives, history, record, report, story, or version. And that expands for me at least a fuzzy, ill-defined concept and helps me to focus on the broader concept of the word. Since the word Jerusalem is represented some 800 times in Strong's, and there are many that are missed, it can be a rather exhaustive and exhausting study. when you go down that road, going to find Zion is something that needs some attention, and also Shiloh. When the word chronicle, or the record, or the report, is used as a noun, it is referring to a chronological record of events, a history. When it is used as a verb, its principal meaning is to record in, or as in, a chronicle of. So we can see, when we walk through the scriptures and we're looking for this reference of Jerusalem, it is a chronicle of things as it pertains to that. And we see both a record and the events of that record recorded. And we just need to be aware of those, as they are helpful to know. There's also another thing that we should keep in mind, is that when God dragged Israel out of Egypt, he had certain expectations for them. One of these is recorded in Exodus 19, verses 3 through 8. Exodus 19, verses 3 through 8. We see some expectations laid out. Verse 3, and Moses went up to God, and Jehovah called him to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel." So again, it's worthy to note that Moses was a mediator, but he was speaking to the entire house of Israel. "You've seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Therefore, if indeed you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, "All that Jehovah has spoken we will do." So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. It's logical to ask, if you had a kingdom of priests and a holy people, what would you want to do with them? What's the point? Would it make sense that such a setup would or could serve as a launching pad to offer salvation to the entire world by teaching it God's ways, by knowledge, and by example? This will make more sense as we move along. If we go to Deuteronomy, where God's instructions to Israel are given prior to them actually entering into the land where God was going to place them, we go to Deuteronomy 11. Deuteronomy 11 and verses 26 through 32. Deuteronomy 11, verse 26 through 32. "Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commandments of Jehovah your God, which I command you today, and the curse, if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after other gods, which you have not known. Now it shall be, when Jehovah your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not on the other side of the Jordan, toward the setting of the sun in the land of the Canaanites, who dwell in the plain opposite of Gilgal, beside the terebinth trees of Moriah? For you will cross over the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and you will possess it and dwell in it. And you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today." If we go on in Deuteronomy 12, "These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which Jehovah God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all to which you have put your hand, you and your households in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing what is right in his own eyes. For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land where the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. That's important. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, and all of the choice offerings which you vow to Jehovah. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is in your gates, since he has no portion nor inheritance with you. Take heed to yourself that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place that you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses in one of your tribes. There you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. So God was going to place his name in one of your tribes. Going down to verse 17. You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain, or your new wine, or your oil, of the firstborn of your herd, or your flock, or any of your dwellings which you vow, of your freewill offerings, of the heave offering of your hand, but you must eat them before the Lord your God, in the place which the Lord your God chooses, you and your son and your daughters, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite who is within your gates. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all in which you put your hands. Going on in verse 20. When the Lord your God enlarges your border, and this is very important, as he has promised you, and you say, well, let me eat meat. Because you long to eat meat, you may eat as much meat as your heart desires. If the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then you may slaughter from your herd and from your flock, which the Lord has given you, just as I commanded you, and you may eat within your gates as much as your heart desires. I did not know that. If the distance was too far, you kept the statutes and judgments locally. Only makes sense. Going on in verse 26 through 28. Only the holy things you have and your vowed offerings you shall take and go to the place which the Lord chooses. And you shall offer your burnt offerings, the meat and blood, on the altar of the Lord your God, and the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of Jehovah your God, and you shall eat the meat. Observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. We must be very careful not to do what is good in our own eyes. We must do what is good in God's eyes, and it is God that determines exactly what that is. And I thought it was interesting that if it was too far, you kept it locally. Can't believe I never saw that before. Well, where was the place that God chose? If you thought it was Jerusalem, as I did, you'd be wrong like me. But we need to fix that. We need to go to the book of Joshua, Joshua 18:1, to understand exactly where it was that God chose to put his name in the first place. Joshua 18, verse 1, it says, Now the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. We go down to verse 8. Then the men arose to go away, and Joshua charged those who went to survey the land, saying, Go walk through the land, survey it, and come back to me, that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord in Shiloh. It's amazing. We think we've studied stuff, and Perhaps everybody out in listening land knew, but this cowboy sure didn't. So the men went, passed through the land, and wrote the survey in a book in seven parts by cities, and they came to Joshua at the camp in Shiloh. Then Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord, and there Joshua divided the land as the children of Israel, according to their divisions. Shiloh, turns out, was in the land of Ephraim. If you go and look on a map, it's north of Jerusalem and a bit east. Not, I don't know how many miles, but a ways. Notice Joshua 19 and verse 51. Joshua 19 and verse 51. These were the inheritances which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel divided as an inheritance by lot in Shiloh before Jehovah at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, so they made an end of dividing the country. Going on to Joshua 21, verses 1 and 2. Then the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites came near to Eleazar the priest, to Joshua the son of Nun, and to the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of Israel. And they spoke to them at Shiloh in the land of Canaan, saying, "The Lord commanded through Moses to give us cities to dwell in with their common lands for our livestock." Going on to Joshua 22:9, again we see reference. So the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the country of Gilead, to the land of their possession, which they had obtained according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And verse 12, and when the children of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. We see a continuation of that in the book of Judges. It turns out that Shiloh is in the land of Ephraim. Again, something I simply did not know. Judges 18:31. Actually, we'll read a couple before that. It is speaking of the tribe of Dan. It's an interesting side note. And they called the name of the city Dan after the name of Dan their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. The children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So you can see within Israel a desire to do it their way, where they appointed for themselves priests, who obviously would have known that the Levites were supposed to be the priests, but no problem, we can take that job on. And the Danites wait for their salvation, we read in Genesis 49, is because they went into idolatry very, very soon. In verse 31, so they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. So they knew where to go, but they weren't having any of that action. So if we go to Judges 21, verse 12, we see other references. Reading in here, it says, so they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. And this is restoring the tribe of Benjamin. They were there for the Feast of Tabernacles in Shiloh. Going on in verse 19, it says, then they said, in fact, there is a yearly feast of Jehovah in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. Well, what else can we learn if we put our minds to it? In 1 Samuel 1, verse 3. And speaking of Samuel, verse 2, actually, he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man, this Samuel, went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And in verse 24, when she had weaned Samuel, she took him up with her with three bulls, one ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of Jehovah in Shiloh. So this is in Ephraim, God's head tribe. Now, if we go to verse 21, we see of the same passage, 1 Samuel, the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. So Shiloh was a hub for a long time. And the Ark of the Covenant was also in Shiloh. And we can learn of that in 1 Samuel 4:3. And when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Well, why has Jehovah defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah from Shiloh to us. And when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." Well, it turns out that this Shiloh hiatus, where the house of God was, lasted for well over 370 years. This wasn't a one-off. It wasn't something that just happened out of the blue. It was there for a long time. God trying to work through the head tribe of Ephraim, but it seemed that that didn't necessarily turn out real good for him as what his intentions were. And it seems as though King David was well aware of this earlier history, something that this researcher knew nothing of, or certainly never paid any attention to when I was looking at it. And it says a contemplation of Asaph in Psalm 78, and Asaph was a very good friend and companion of David, so he's the one that put this together. And it says, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which have been heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of Jehovah and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them. So we have a responsibility today, as they did at that time, to teach our children the things of God. Because you can be rest assured that if we don't do that, the world will teach them of their God, and they won't know the difference." Going on in verse 6 of chapter 78 of Psalms, "that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children." So God wanted a perpetuity of understanding, and the responsibility lay on the parents to teach their children the things of God, that they may set their hope in God and do not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. And we've learned in past studies that it's our spirit is the prize. It is what goes back to God, and it needs to be in harmony and at one with God so that God might take our spirit and place it in a spirit body in his family. And here we go on. Remember that Shiloh was in Ephraim. "The children of Ephraim," in verse 9, "being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law, forgot his works and his wonders that he had shown them. Marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through, and he made the waters stand up like a heap. In the daytime also he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance, like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness, and they tested God in their heart by asking for the food of their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God. They said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he give us bread also? Can he provide meat for his people?" Therefore, Jehovah heard this and was furious. Well, no kidding. And part of what we're going through here is we need to come to understand how our Father thinks. And when we don't think like he thinks, we need to fix that. That's what repentance and becoming one with God the Father is all about. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. And yet he had commanded the clouds above and opened the door of heaven, had rained down manna on them to eat and given them the bread of heaven. Men ate angels' food. He sent them food to the full. Still wasn't enough. He caused an east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He also rained meat on them like the dust, feathered fowl like the sand of the seas, and he let them fall in the midst of their camp all around their dwellings. Didn't even have to kill them. So they ate and were well filled, for he gave them their own desire. They were not deprived of their craving, but while their food was still in their mouths, the wrath of God came against them and slew the stoutest of them and struck down the choice men of Israel. In spite of this, they still sinned and did not believe in his wondrous works. Therefore, their days he consumed in futility and their years in fear. When he slew them, then they sought him, and they returned and sought earnestly for God. Then they remembered that God was their rock and the Most High God their Redeemer. Nevertheless, they flattered him with their mouth and they lied to him with their tongue, for their heart was not steadfast with them, nor were they faithful in his covenant. You know, let's not and say we did is an old game. Been going on for a long time. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. Yes, many a time he turned his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a breath that passes away and does not come again. How often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power the day when he redeemed them from the enemy, when he worked his signs in Egypt, and his wonders in the field of Zoan, turned their rivers into blood, their streams that they could not drink. He sent swarms of flies among them which devoured them, and frogs which destroyed them. He also gave their crops to the caterpillar and their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail, and their sycamore trees with frost. He also gave up their cattle to the hail and their flocks to fiery lightning. He cast on them the fierceness of his anger, wrath, indignation, and trouble by sending angels of destruction among them. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare their soul from death, but gave their life over to the plague and destroyed all the firstborn in Egypt, the first of their strength in the tents of Ham. But he made his own people go forth like sheep, and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. And he led them on safely so that they did not fear. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies, and he brought them to his holy border, this mountain which his right hand had acquired. And he also drove out the nations before them, allotted them by an inheritance by survey, and made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. Yet the game still goes the same, yet they tested and provoked the Most High God. And they did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images. Ephraim and the Israelites were in idolatry up to their ears. They would not worship God. And isn't that the case? You look about and you see some very good people are quite willing to keep the last six commandments, but they will not. They just won't keep the first four. Going on, when God heard this, he was furious and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh. Remember, it had been there for nearly 400 years. The tent he had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hands. He gave his people over to the sword and was furious with his inheritance. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given in marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made noble lamentation. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep, like a mighty man who shouts because of wine. And he beat back his enemies. He put them to a perpetual reproach. Moreover, something I did not know, he rejected the tent of Joseph. His tabernacle was in Ephraim, in Shiloh, for centuries. And we just heard why he rejected them. And he did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth which he has established forever. He also chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes that had young. He brought them to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. And now we know how we got to Jerusalem. It was after the rejection of Ephraim in Shiloh. If we go to the book of Jeremiah, there's a rather interesting passage here in Jeremiah 7, where we see some historical perspective of this, and how we see we did get to an instant replay. Asaph understood the history, knew what was going on. And so with that understanding, let's now go to Jeremiah 7 and see if we can contextually put this in place. The word that came to Jeremiah from Jehovah saying, "Stand in the gate of Jehovah's house." This is in Jerusalem now. We know why it was moved. "And proclaim there this word, 'Hear the word of Jehovah, all you of Judah who enter in at these gates to worship Jehovah. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Do not trust in these lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, and the temple of the Lord are these. For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you don't oppress the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, or walk after other gods to your hurt." Does this sound familiar to the dance at Shiloh? "Then I will cause you to dwell in this place in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever." Was God all in on this when he put his presence in Shiloh and he gave them his holy days? Was he establishing a kingdom that he was prepared to work with and deal with forever? Yes. And because of Israel's refusal to do so, over and over, we read a lot of the Old Testament prophecy about the restoration of all things, and what's God going to do? He's going to set up a righteous nation in the Middle East, and it will be the spearhead of the conversion of the whole world. He's never changed. The people he chose to work with booted it bad. The story's the same. It's consistent. What's the problem? Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you do not know? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all of these abominations? I'm in the right church. I go to the right church. I can do whatever I want. Right. Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of thieves in your eyes? Behold, I, even I, have seen it, says Jehovah. But go now to my place, which was in Shiloh. Go take a look, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these works, says the Lord, and I spoke to you, rising up early and speaking, but you didn't hear, and I called you, but you didn't answer. Therefore I will do to the house which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast out all your brethren, the whole posterity of Ephraim. Therefore, do not pray for this people, nor lift up a cry or prayer for them, and nor make intercession to me. I will not hear you. Do you not see what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, which was to be a centerpiece of righteousness to God? The children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead dough to make cakes for the Queen of Heaven. They chose to worship demons rather than to worship God the Father. And they pour out drink offerings to other gods that they may provoke me to anger. Do they provoke me to anger, says Jehovah? Do they not provoke themselves to the shame of their own faces? They had the true God, and they went for the false? Therefore, says the Lord God, behold, my anger and my fury will be poured out on this place, on man and on beast, on the trees of the field and on the fruit of the ground, and it will burn and not be quenched. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat meat. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but followed the counsels and dictates of their evil hearts, and went backward and not forward. The story is the same over and over and over again. Since the day that your fathers came out of the land of Egypt, until this day, I have even sent to you all my servants, the prophets, daily rising up early and sending them. You notice here, you see this constant reference, my servants. Is that not what you and I are to become, as servants to God? So that when he does set up the kingdom and restores Israel to his holy land, that all things will be in place, and we will serve our God. Yet they did not obey me, or incline their ear, but stiffened their neck. They did worse than their fathers. Therefore you shall speak all these words to them, but they won't obey you. You shall also call to them, but they won't answer you. So you shall say to them, this is a nation that does not obey the voice of Jehovah their God, nor receive correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. People don't want truth. They don't want to hear truth today. And we have a wonderful tool that's been given to us. It's called the Holy Bible. God does not and cannot lie. So we have a book that we can go to when we're staring out into this world, which is built on nothing but lies. And we can go and read here and read exactly what the truth is. And I have seen over and over again that my own personal development and the personal development of others is that when God says something, we either don't pay attention to it or we don't believe it. Written by the prophets as they were inspired by God, who cannot lie. So when we read stuff and we look at that and say, well, that can't possibly be true, are we not calling God a liar? Might think about that. It's pretty amazing exactly how it plays that out. So again, verse 28, so you shall say to them, this is a nation that does not obey God. It does not obey the voice of the Lord your God, nor receive correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. Cut off your hair and cast it away, and take up a lamentation on the desolate heights, for the Lord has rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, says Jehovah. They've set their abominations in the house, which is called by my name, to pollute it. And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come from my heart. So this is what Judah did, even after Israel had long gone into captivity. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when it will no more be called Tophet, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter, for they will bury in Tophet, until there is no room. The corpses of this people will be for food, for the birds of the heavens and for the beasts of the earth, and no one will frighten them away. There's going to come a day of recompense. Then I will cause to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, for the land shall be desolate. You know, the interesting part is God's ecclesia are the temple of God. And we read in the New Testament, if we defile our temple, God will destroy us. What did he do with the temple in Shiloh? He destroyed it. What did he ultimately do with the temple of Solomon? He destroyed it. Were the reasons the same for the temple in Shiloh, where God had placed his name, and the temple in Jerusalem, where God had placed his name? Same reasons. You and I are the temple of the living God. I think sometimes we need to think about that position. Well, how did it all begin when a temple was erected for God to dwell in? What can we learn from Solomon's dedication prayer? What did Solomon actually understand? As Israel once looked to Shiloh for direction as God was there, was the same true of Jerusalem? What was the expectation, even though it was working through kings now, as opposed to the nation generally, and the nation generally had rejected God? What about that? What does that mean? And you know, what's interesting to consider in terms of the whole calendar thing, when the temple was in Shiloh, and the directions was, when you start your harvest, when you put the sickle to the grain, you go to where God placed his name. Well, where did he place his name? They went to Shiloh. Where was the spearhead of worship to God located? Would you just do what you wanted to locally? Or did you do what you could locally because the distance was too far, but you recognized and acknowledged that the feast timing generated from the place where God placed his name? What did you do? How did you deal with that? Remember, the direction, when we go back to the calendar thing, was given to the people. When you do this, then you do that. Was there a directive that ran out of Shiloh to tell everybody what to do? Not that I can find. We do need to think about these things. It's important that we do. So I think we'll just leave it there. Want to move ahead in 1 Kings 8, which is also in the book of 2 Chronicles, the prayer of dedication that Solomon gave about the temple. What was the drill? What was to be accomplished? What was God's will in establishing that? How does that all factor in? So we'll just leave that as far as we take it today. Hopefully the history of Shiloh, totally missed by me, like completely missed by me, was of some interest to you, and to show and see that God's thinking has been consistent. So when we read, "I don't change," we can believe that, because no, he doesn't. So until next time, when we get to take a second look at the Jerusalem Chronicles, we will take another look at it and see what other things that we can possibly learn from our examination of this, to me, very interesting topic. Pleasant remainder of the Sabbath to you all, and we'll be in touch as we can. Bye now.